Hello, folks. Welcome back to World War II TV, and it's Friday. So this is the fifth of our shows this week, and joining me for our final show is Steve Snyder. Steve will be sharing the story of his father and his father's time with the 8th Air Force and how he was shot down in 1944. The links to Steve's books and his website are, as always, in the description below. We've had a few new subscribers over these last few days. If you are new, welcome to the channel. I hope you explore our back catalogue. And as I just said there, all the information you always need is in the description. And maybe you'll consider buying some merchandise or becoming a patron or a YouTube channel member. Without further ado, I'm going to bring Steve in. Good afternoon, Steve. How are you today?
I'm doing great, Paul. Good to be here.
And you're in your second home in Arizona today. You live in California, in Arizona today. So is it hot there today?
No, not too bad. It's June here, so it'll be about 85 degrees Fahrenheit. Very nice.
That's really hot for me as a pasty Englishman living in the coast of France. But anyway, we're delighted to have you here. So when this week, the theme has been, you know, the air crews being very good at their jobs. They're embracing the fear in a sense by getting on with their job, getting on with their bit, whether they're an air gunner, whether they're a pilot, whether they're a navigator, whatever it would be. And then suddenly, and it is usually suddenly, there you are, your aircraft's been hit. So we're looking forward to hearing your father's experiences. And also, I know from your presentation, it's all about how you put the story together as well, because the research process and meeting up with veterans and air crews and going around and touring around. So we're looking forward to it. So I'll bring your PowerPoint up and you're in charge of things. So, folks, if you've got questions for Steve, fire away as we go along. But basically, I'm going to hand over to our expert who's done a presentation like this several times before. So we're in good hands. He knows what he's doing. So shot down. So your book and my theme week share the same two word titles. That's fantastic. So over to you, Steve, and I'll jump in with questions when I have them.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. He flew bombing missions over Europe, and in February of 1944, his plane was shot down, and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually made it back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I had the time to really delve into my dad's war history in more detail. My parents had kept a lot of material from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and find out more details and organize it. And at that time, I had no intention at all of writing a book. I just wanted to learn a little bit more. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. That's absolutely riveting. It's in the book, so much so that it was included in two books that were written. On the left is The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor. That was about the 8th Air Force who flew high altitude, daylight precision bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. Their first mission was on August 17th of 1942. And the goal was to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The 8th Air Force got the moniker the Mighty Eighth by noted historian Roger Freeman because of the number of bombers they could put up on missions, which numbered into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin, which is hard to imagine that many bombers being in the air. You know, as some bombers were dropping their bombs, other bombers hadn't even taken off from England yet. The other book was First Over Germany about the 306 bomb group that my dad was in. It was written by Russell Strong, who was a navigator in the 306 bomb group and became its historian after the war. The motto of the 306 was First Over Germany because they were the first bomb group in the 8th Air Force to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad wrote to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And he was really candid in these letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, what life was like on the air base in England at Thurlow, what life was like in London and England at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. And I became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet, spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all my dad's crew members to find out what information they could give to me. started going to World War II reunions, listening to veterans tell their stories. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. And I actually formed my own publishing company to publish the book, Seabreeze Publishing, which is the name of the street that I live on in Beach, California. And the first half of the book builds up to the day that the plane was shot down. And then the second half of the book is all about what happens afterwards. And it's just not about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of his crew. And also about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. But I couldn't have written in the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. On the left with my dad, who has the bomber jacket on, is Dr. Paul Delahaye. That picture was taken in 1994, the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium and of my dad's plane being shot down. And on the right-hand side is Jacques Lalot, seen with me 20 years later at the 70th anniversary. And I'll be going over to Belgium next year for the 80th anniversary. During the war, these gentlemen were young boys and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And they became local historians later in life, and they interviewed all these Belgian people, members of the Belgium underground, about events that took place involving my dad and his crew. And they documented their testimony, and they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever. So I owe them a huge debt.
I just want to jump in just very briefly, Steve, because there is an absolute wealth of books about the 8th Air Force and the bomber offensive generally. And I'm glad that you're bringing in people who are living in Europe, because my experience, and Joost de Graaf is watching, who's done an appearance on World War II TV, most Europeans are interested in the air crews that didn't make it back, the memorials, the graves they visit at cemeteries, the personal experiences and things like that. And most Americans and Brits who are looking at the war are looking at their own relative, their grandfathers, their great uncles, their fathers. But then there's the other thread, is the study about whether or not the combined bomber offensive worked or not. And here's how it didn't work. And here's how it worked. And when they meant precision bombing, did they mean this? Did they mean that? And I find those books very interesting as well. But to me, it's a completely separate study. You know, there's the study of human beings who are just taking to the air in aircraft, who have no part of the decision making, no part of the strategy, no part of the doctrine. And then there's these very learned discussions about whether or not it works. And I have to say, I like hearing stories like yours and your father's, where it's just about the people and what happened to them. And the conversations about the merits of the campaign are separate. And I'm glad that we're focusing on what we're focusing on today. That was my little comment there.
Well, that's exactly what I'm going to do. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by President Roosevelt. In the fall of 1940, my dad went into the Army in the infantry, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. And at the time, when World War II started, U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Romania. And they were very ill-equipped as well, as you can see by this World War I vintage uniform that my dad has on here. And then 3 months later, he married Ruth Hempel, First Lutheran Church in Pasadena, California. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena, California, as was I. It was shortly after she graduated from UCLA, where she was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. My dad was born in Norfolk, Nebraska, and he moved to California with his family when he was 13. And a few months later, on December 7th, on a date which will live in infamy, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor and the United States was at war. Well, my mother was very afraid. The future was very uncertain. So at Christmas time, she went up to Washington to visit my dad. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, at the time, my dad was concerned how he was going to support his new family as a new bride, a baby on the way. And he didn't think he could do that very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, where he could make more money, especially if he could make it through pilot training and become an officer. So in March of 1942, he went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana, California. And then he went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's kind of busy, but on the left-hand side, you see the three main stages of pilot training. First, you have primary training. And then if you made it through primary, you went into basic. And pilot training was very tough. 40% of the cadets that entered washed out and either became bombardiers or navigators or perhaps gunners. And then after basic, they separated the pilots out. They either went into single engine planes, which are fighters, or two engine planes, bombers or transports. Typically the shorter pilots went into the fighters. My dad was 6'3", so they put him in the two engine planes. But I personally think it also determined or was based on personality. It seems to me fighter pilots' personalities, they tended to be have kind of large egos, kind of be pretty cocky, independent, risk takers, whereas the bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad in primary training in Santa Maria, California. This was a big day for my dad because that was the first time he ever soloed. And you could always tell because they couldn't wear their goggles on top of their helmets until they had soloed. You see him smoking here. I think everyone smoked back then during the war. These are the three types of planes that my dad flew in pilot training. Up on top is in primary training is a Sturman biplane. And then in basic training in the middle, you have a Volte Valiant single wing plane. And then on the lower picture, in advanced pilot training, he flew a Curtiss-Wright 18-9 twin-engine plane. My dad graduated from pilot training in April of 1943, where he earned his pilot's wings and his commission as a second lieutenant. And from there, he went to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. And then from there, he went to operational crew training, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. My dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group at Thurlow, England on October 21st, 1943. Thurlow is about 60 miles north of London and a little bit west. That's what the base looked like back then. The base isn't there anymore, but the countryside looks just the same. It's all rural farmland.
We always get the question, Steve, did they fly that B-17 over the channel themselves or were they taken over by a troop ship? That's one of the questions that always comes up when we're talking about these kind of discussions.
That is a great question. Yeah, my dad, they got a brand new bomber in Scott Field in Illinois. And then they went to Maine and then to Newfoundland and then flew to Scotland from there. My dad said it was pretty scary. Because, you know, they're flying at night, it's pitch black, and there's no identification points. But he said his navigator did a good job of getting them there.
If you don't do a good job of navigating, you don't get there. Basically, the margin is quite fine. So it's very much an in at the deep end experience, isn't it? You make it or you crash in the sea, in a sense. We always get that question. So thanks for explaining.
Yeah, that was a good question. There is a nice little museum there where the base is now that even though it's small, has an amazing amount of artifacts and memorabilia inside. My wife and I have visited there several times. Here you see the insignia of the 306 Bomb Group. There were three air divisions in the 8th Air Force. The 306 was in the 1st Air Division, which was signified by a triangle. And then every bomb group in the 8th Air Force had a designated letter, which for the 306 was an H. So the triangle H designated the 306 Bomb Group. Most people or a lot of people have seen the 1949 movie 12 O'Clock High starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 Bomb Group. The fictitious bomb group in the movie, the Night 18th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by 3. Another distinction of the 306 Bomb Group is that their flight surgeon, Dr. Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Bomber Command General Ira Aker to implement a mission limit in April of 1943. Prior to that, there was no mission limit, and the morale of these combat crews was going into the tank because they realized they would never, ever make it back home. They'd either be killed or shot down and become a prisoner of war. Dr. Schuller suggested a mission limit of 20, Acre set it at 25, but at least these bomber crews had a light at the end of the tunnel and a goal and something they could shoot for with the hope of maybe making it back home. When Jimmy Doolittle took over the 8th Air Force in January of 44, he raised the mission limit to 30 and then 35. Every bomb group had four bomb squadrons. These are the four bomb squadrons in the 306. On the upper left is the Clay Pigeons, so named by a newspaper man in England. They took more losses than any other bomb squadron in the 8th Air Force during the war. And then my dad's bomb squadrons in the lower right-hand corner, the 369th Fighting Biting. I always like to point out the ground crews. The combat crews got all the glory and the recognition, but these ground crews are the ones that kept these planes flying. After missions, they would stay up all night long, usually in very inclement weather, sleet, snow, rain, ice, mud, getting these bombers back together, ready to go back out on missions. They repair battle damage, do maintenance on the plane, replace tires, replace engines. And they took great pride in the plane that they took care of. They really felt that it was their plane, and they just loaned it out to the combat crews occasionally to fly missions. So they were really the unsung heroes. Here you see my dad's crew, B-17, had a 10-man crew. There were four officers kneeling in front. My dad is in the lower left. He was the first pilot. As such, the commander of the crew and the plane, and then going across, you have a co-pilot, the navigator, and a bombardier. And then behind them, you have six enlisted men, non-commissioned officers, who were mainly gunners. This crew of 10, five of these men made it home, but five of them did not. This is not the Susan Ruth, this B-17 here. That's just a B-17 that they took their crew picture in front of when they arrived in England. I always like to point out the nose art. I love the nose art. It's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Navy didn't, the Marines didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it helped the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes. And they were very creative in what they named their planes and painted on their planes. Many times it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, like this picture here, was a scantily clad or nude woman. You know, after all, these guys are in their late teens and early 20s and were very young men. The 306 flew B-17s. The 1st Air Division and the 3rd Air Division flew B-17s, and the 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. The B-17 was nicknamed the Flying Fortress because of the armament they had on the plane. They had 12 to 13 50 caliber machine guns and could put out a tremendous amount of firepower. They could also take a tremendous amount of battle damage and keep flying. Each plane had tail markings to identify them. Here again, you see the triangle H of the 306 bomb group and the 1st Air Division. And then below that, there's a serial number that was assigned by the manufacturer. The Boeing company produced, well, actually designed the B-17 and produced 60% of the B-17s, but Lockheed Vega and Douglas Aircraft each produced 20% as well. There were three types of or models of B-17s flown in Europe. First was the E model, but they only made about 500 of those, so it was quickly phased out by the F model. And then in the fall of 1943, it was started to be phasing out by the definitive B-17 model, the G model. And you can always tell the G model by the chin turret underneath the nose of the plane. Here you see the crew positions. Again, this is a G model with the chin turret up in the nose. You have the bombardier, the navigator, and up above them, the two pilots, the flight engineer, then the bomb bay. Behind the bomb bay, you have the radio operator. Then behind him, the ball turret gunner, two waist gunners, and then a tail gunner. The bombs hung up in the bomb bay on racks. And it was really tight in that compartment. This boy's only 8 years old, and that catwalk is 8 inches wide. So it was really cramped. It was more cramped in a B-17 than in a submarine. And you can see the bombs here, they hung up on racks. And occasionally the bombs would get caught and they wouldn't release, which would require one of the airmen to either kick it loose with his foot or take a wrench and knock it loose. When that bomb bay doors open during a bomb run, you're looking 5 miles straight down to the ground. So that took some courage to do that. Here you see the crew positions a little more clearly. This is the F model without the chin turret. Here again, you have the bombardier. His main job was to drop the bombs accurately. But in the G model, he manned the chin turret when they were attacked by enemy fighters. And then behind him was the navigator. He needed to know where they were and where they were going. And when under attack by enemy fighters, he manned cheek guns that were on each side of the nose. Then up above them, you have the two pilots, the first pilot, my dad in the left seat, the co-pilot in the right seat. And you needed two pilots to fly these planes. And not just because if one was killed or injured, you had another guy that could do the job. But it was really strenuous, both mentally and physically, to fly these planes. Back then, it took muscle to fly these bombers. And they had to stay alert at all times. If they didn't, they could run and clip a wing on the plane next to them because they flew in tight formations, or run into a plane in front of them and go down. And the missions were typically 6 to 10 hours in length, so they were very tiring. And they also had to continually fight the air turbulence, and not just the turbulence of the weather, but all the turbulence of those bombers being in such close proximity to one another. The wake turbulence and the prop wash would just churn the air like a washing machine. So again, it took muscle to really keep them in these formations without running into other planes. Then above them, you have the top turret gunner, the flight engineer. He manned the turret if they were under attack. He was also called the crew chief. He was kind of the onboard mechanic and knew how everything worked. And he helped monitor all the instruments that were in the cockpit. There were over 150 different gauges, dials, toggles, and switches. And the flight engineer would peer over the pilot's shoulders to help monitor engine performance and fuel consumption. And then behind the bomb bay, you have the radio operator. That was the most comfortable position on the plane. He had a fairly roomy compartment, a chair to sit at. And then the most uncomfortable position on the plane, the ball turret gunner. Again, these missions were 6 to 10 hours in length, and he's in this fetal position for hours on end, which was very uncomfortable. And you have the two waist gunners, which was the most exposed position on the plane, and then another cramped position, the tail gunner. My dad flew his first mission on November 3rd of 1943 to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. It was the first time the 8th Air Force put up 500 bombers on a mission. And flying combat was extremely dangerous and brutal. It was dangerous from the time they took off to the time they landed. To begin with, at the peak, there were 40 bomb groups in the 8th Air Force located in East Anglia, England, which is about the size of Vermont. And these bases were located only about 5 or 10 miles apart. So on the day of a mission, you could have hundreds of bombers taken off all at the same time. And back then, there was no air traffic control. There was no radar. And usually the weather was crummy and sock dim, and they couldn't see anything until they got above the cloud layer. So mid-air collisions were not uncommon. Airmen lost their lives. And then they had to form up. Three planes formed up into elements. Elements formed up into bomb squadrons. Bomb squadrons formed up into bomb groups. Bomb groups formed up into combat wings. Combat wings formed up into air divisions. And all this took 1 to 2 hours before they could even begin their mission across the English Channel. And then they had to deal with the elements. These planes weren't pressurized, so above 10,000 feet, they had to go on oxygen, or else they'd pass out in a couple of minutes and could die. And also, it was extremely cold at the altitude they were flying. It was minus 40 to 60 degrees below zero. So frostbite was a huge problem. And many men suffered serious frostbite injuries and spent lengthy periods of time in the hospital. One of my dad's waist gunners had frostbite. He was in the hospital for 2.5 months. Here you see the combat uniform that they wore. This was a waist gunner. He has a steel helmet on, his tinted goggles, his oxygen mask, and then he's wearing a flak jacket, which is like an apron with metal plates in front and back to help protect him. His fleece-lined jacket, pants, thermal gloves and boots, and then the white strap around his waist, that was a parachute harness. It was so cramped in these B-17s that they couldn't wear their parachutes. They had to bail out. They had to have their wits about them to find their parachute to start with, and then clip it on hooks on the back of the harness, and then bail out of the plane. again, you see the creative nose art here. This is the not a B-17. That's actually a B-24 Liberator. The next thing they had to deal with was the German Air Force called the Luftwaffe. The Germans had radar stations set up along the continental coast of Europe, so they knew when these bomber formations were coming, and they'd send up their fighters to intercept them. Here you see a waist gunner firing his 50 caliber machine gun, and you can see his flak jacket on again here, and then he's all these spent cartridges on the floor of the plane. That was like stepping on ball bearings or marbles. This is the 50 caliber machine gun, and the ammunition came in belts of 27 feet in length. So if a gunner fired the whole belt, they said he fired the whole 9 yards, and that's where that expression came from. The next thing they had to deal with, well, let me step back a minute. At the beginning of the war, it was 8th Bomber Command's belief that these heavily armed bombers flying in tight formations of hundreds of bombers at a time could defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And they flew in what was called the combat box formation. And here you see the combat box of a combat wing. And then within the box of the wing, you have 3 boxes representing bomb groups. And then with each box of a bomb group, you have 3 boxes representing bomb squadrons. So the theory was that all this interlacing firepower could ward off the German Luftwaffe. But sadly, that was not the case. They could not defend themselves from the Luftwaffe. And even when they started getting fighter support, fighters at the time, the Spitfires or P-47s didn't have the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way deep into Germany. They could go across the English Channel, maybe into France a little ways, but then they'd run low of fuel and they have to turn it back to their bases in England. Well, the Luftwaffe would just wait until they turned back and they'd come in and attack the bombers. The losses culminated in 1943, and even though they implemented that mission limit in April of 43 of 25 missions, it was statistically impossible to complete 25 missions. The average number of missions flown in 1943 before being shot down was only 6. And the losses culminated in October of 1943 in what was referred to as Black Week, where over 4 missions, the 8th Air Force lost 148 bombers. That's almost 1,500 men. The worst day was October 14th, referred to as Black Thursday, when they sent 291 B-17s to bomb the ball bearing factories at Schweinfurt, Germany. And 60 of those bombers were shot down. 10 of the 15 bombers, B-17s from the 306 bomb group, were shot down. Well, the 8th Air Force was in shock after that. There was absolutely no way they could continue sustaining losses like that. And they discontinued any bombing into Germany for the remainder of the year. It wasn't until the P-47s got external fuel tanks and the introduction of the P-51 Mustang right at the end of the 43, the beginning of 44, that these bomber formations finally had escorts could take them all the way deep into Germany to the target and bring them back home. The P-51s were particularly effective. They basically just wiped out the Luftwaffe. By the time D-Day rolled around, June 6th of 44, the Luftwaffe had been decimated. Mm. Here you see, that's another view of the formation from the front, from the up on top and the side. Mm. It was a three-dimensional formation with a lead group, a high group, and then a low group.
And just to jump in very briefly, Steve, I think everyone watching this, and myself included, we're all hoping that when Masters of the Air finally reaches our screens, whenever it's going to reach our screens, we've been waiting for it for so long, it will show this chart, this development, in that the 8th Air Force was progressively trying to improve the odds, you know, improve the strike rates, improve the accuracy, improve the safety of the crews, the box formation, et cetera, et cetera. It can't surely just be 10 episodes of B-17s flying over and getting shot at. They're going to have an arc of all the doctrinal efforts being made to try and improve the accuracy and improve everything. I hope so. That's what everyone's really hoping. It will show that it wasn't the finished force in 1943. It wasn't finished when it started. By 1945, it had finally become perhaps what people were promising was going to be several years earlier.
excellent point. There are going to be a number of story of arcs about different guys. Actually, it's really the Masters of the Air is going to be about the 100th Bomb Group and about particular men in the 100th Bomb Group. Although one thing that I've heard about Masters of the Air, which is not good, it's just going to include the Tuskegee Airmen that weren't even in the 8th Air Force. The Tuskegee Airmen, the Red Tails, were in the 15th Air Force out of the Mediterranean. So there will be some inaccuracy.
I feel they're going to squeeze a bit of everything in it that they think they should do that's popular. There'll be Tiger tanks. There'll be a POW. Hitler's bound to be in it as well. There's bound to be love stories. But yeah, we're all... The weight is killing me, frankly. I just want to see it now and be able to sit back. And I'm going to go into it open-minded and understand it's an entertainment. It's not aimed at people like ourselves who know a little bit about this. But I just wish it would come out so we can all see it. John Orloff, the writer, I've exchanged a few emails. We've chatted with him a few times. But he's signed a no non-disclosure agreement. He can't say anything yet until it comes out. But fingers crossed it'll be good.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be good.
Anyway, back to you.
Yeah, here's an example of the P-51 Mustang. For those of you who have seen Top Gun Maverick, this is Tom Cruise's P-51. I took this picture in the Planes of Fame Air Museum in Chino, California. But they were quite the plane. The next thing they had to deal with was anti-aircraft fire. This is a flak gun. Flak was the abbreviation for the German word for aircraft defense cannon. And these were deadly weapons. They fired 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode at the same altitude that these bombers were flying. And these shells were filled, with all different shapes and sizes of razor-sharp metal called shrapnel. And when they'd explode, it burst out hundreds of feet and easily penetrate the thin aluminum skin of these bombers. From a distance, they look like innocent black puffs, but when these bomber formations got into that killing field, the puffs got bigger, the explosions became louder, shells exploding near the ship, which just violently rocked the plane. My dad said even though it was so cold at that altitude, he would be sweating profusely and his clothes would be dripping wet, with the adrenaline running through his body. If a bomber was hit directly by one of these shells, it would basically just explode and disintegrate and disappear. Or if it hit a wing and knocked the wing off, these planes would just plummet to the earth. When they reached the predetermined point on their mission called the IP, or initial point, that's when they started their bomb run. And at that time, the first pilot would give control over the plane to the bombardier, who would fly the plane through the Norden bomb site. It was a revolutionary device at the time. It was an analog computer that could calculate various factors, such as the altitude the plane was flying, the speed of the plane, the wind speed, wind direction, so it could accurately drop the bombs. And they were also highly secretive. Bombardiers had to take an oath to defend this with their life. But little did the U.S. know at the time that the Germans had a spy, Hermann Lang, in the Norden bomb factory and knew all about it. Here you see the bombardier looking through the crosshairs of the bomb site. And once he released the bombs, he'd yell, "Bombs away." And that would signal the first pilot to take control of the plane back. And he'd make a big turn to go to another pre-designated point called the rally point, where the various bombers that made it through the bomb run would try to form up again and then head back to their bases in England, where once again they'd have to face enemy fighters. And even when they reached England, they had a number of dangers to deal with. These planes could be running out of fuel. There could be dead or injured pilots on board. They could have the weather could be socked in. They couldn't even find their bases to land. The plane could have a lot of battle damage, engines out, flight control shot out, landing gear that didn't come down, which resulted in crash landings, which again resulted in more airmen losing their lives. It was on a bombing mission to Frankfurt, Germany, on February 8th of 1944, when my dad's plane, the Susan Ruth, dropped their bombs successfully, but the bomb bay doors got hit by flak and they couldn't get them back up. And as a result, that caused a drag in the plane. They started losing airspeed and they fell behind the bomber formation returning to England. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf 190 fighters. like wolves or lions on prey, they swept down and attacked the Susan Ruth. In the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. But both those Focke-Wulfs were shot down at the same time. One was piloted by Siegfried Merritt. His plane crashed in Belgium and he was killed. The other plane was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and he made it through the war. During my research one day, my wife, Glenda, said, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I'm thinking to myself, oh gosh, she's naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It's a ridiculous idea. It'd be impossible to find him. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do, and I found Hans Berger. Oh. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war and speaks perfect English. And he gave me wonderful information about what it was like to go up against the Air Force that's in the book. Of my dad's 10-man crew, two crewmen were killed in the plane, the radar operator and the ball turret gunner. And the other eight men were able to bail out. I don't have time to go into what happened to all the guys. It's all in the book, so you have to read the book to find out. But some became prisoners of war. Some evaded capture. Some evaded for a while and were captured and killed. But all amazing stories. For my dad, after he bailed out, he came down in these trees right at the French-Belgian border. And his parachute got hung up in the branches and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and he couldn't get down. But fortunately for him, a couple of young Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Dervan, came to his rescue before the Germans got there. This happened in early afternoon. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, helped my dad down the tree and told him to stay put and hide till nighttime because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him in daylight with German patrols combing the area looking for these guys who bailed out. Here you see Henri Franken, one of the men who helped my dad down this specific tree. These pictures were taken by Henri Franken or his family and sent back to my dad after the war. There's over 200 time period photographs in the book, so you can visualize everything you're reading about. Mm. That night, they came back and got him and took him to the Dervan farmhouse. That house is still there today. And it is right at the French-Belgian border. That house is in Belgium, but those trees are in France. So it's right at the border there. He stayed there one night because, again, they thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that with German patrols combing the area. So the next night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilquin, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. And they headed out in the middle of the night. My dad said it was rainy, miserable night, pitch black. And they started off on the bike. He had some shrapnel wounds in one leg, so he could only pedal with his good leg. And they came to a hill, and they couldn't pedal it up anymore, so they started pushing the bike up the hill. When they got to the top of the hill, they came to a cabaret or a cafe. This is what the building looked like in 1994. And the lights were on, people were laughing, music was playing. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out the front door with two young French girls. One of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around him and asks for a light for a cigarette. My dad's petrified. He couldn't speak German. And at that time, he hadn't learned to speak French yet. But fortunately, Paul Tilquin knew what they wanted and lit the guy's cigarette, and they let him go on their way. My dad said these German officers were too drunk and too interested in these young girls to pay much attention to a couple guys of pushing a bike up in the rain in the middle of the night.
And just a quick question for you, Steve, because it connects to what we were talking about yesterday with the other Steve, one of the three Steves this week, is your father, you know, he's flying missions over Germany, over France and Belgium. Did he say anything in his diary or to you about what their preparations were when they were flying over France and Belgium compared to Germany? Because over Germany, if you're shot down, you pretty much can assume everybody out there is an enemy. But in France or Belgium, you just don't know. You know, who do you trust? Who do you not trust? Were they given any kind of system to follow of how to kind of gauge the reaction of people you might bump into on the ground?
No, not at all. This was all new to the Air Force. You know, no one had ever been shot down and, you know, tried to evade capture. And so they really didn't know what to expect, because Belgium and the Netherlands or France, they were occupied by the Germans. Yeah. So the enemy is everywhere. I mean, it was worth, like you inferred to, in Germany, because you have the local German citizens whose cities are being bombed and they're losing relatives and loved ones from the bombing. So they did have literally an axe to grind. And there were some airmen that were shot down in Germany, which were killed by German civilians.
No, I mean, and it seems from previous shows we've done is that depending on what bomb group you're in, which the air division you're in, some of them seem to spend longer briefing their crews. Some of them had, you know, areas set up in the messes with information and would brief their crews on what you might. Others still didn't do it. There was a certain amount of the individual commanders at their own discretion, how much they were explained to people. I mean, we know from previous shows that organizations like MI9 were gradually gathering information and were putting together packages of escape and evasion. But the fact is, it didn't get to everybody who probably needed it. And as the war went on, the information became more available. So if you were flying in early 45, you were probably getting a better package of information than if you'd been flying in the middle of 1943. But it is interesting that people's experiences are so very different of what they've been told by the, depending on where they were and what group they're in and what part of the, which period of the war they're flying in.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, as airmen were being shot down and then some of them, you know, got back to England through escape routes, you know, then they got more information and they knew what to expect after you bail out. And like you say, you know, later, the further along in the war it got, the more information they had and the more education they could give the flyers.
Yeah, brilliant. Well, back to you. People are loving it, by the way, that there's not many questions coming in because I think you're being so good and you're covering everything. They're just spellbound. So that's a good sign.
Well, after Paul picked up my dad, he was taken. He stayed from place to place. How long he stayed in any given location depended upon how brave the Belgian people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgian people, the Belgium underground, thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. Here you see an example of some of my dad's helpers. He had many more helpers than this. He sees my dad has that they stuck a beret on him to help him kind of blend in with the locals. But being 6'3", my dad was quite a bit taller than the Belgian people. And the Belgian people who helped my dad, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave people. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends. Because if the German secret police, the Gestapo, found out about it, they would be arrested, tortured, and either sent to concentration camps or shot. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew didn't meet that fate. Mm. Here you see a couple of women that my dad stayed with lengthy periods of time. On the left is Ghislaine Bayou. It was with her and her husband, Maurice, that my dad wrote his diary. And on the right is Jeanette Gadin. Her husband was actually a captain in the French army who had been captured in May of 1940 when Germany first invaded the lowlands. But he made it through the war, thankfully. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad in these escape networks. And he became very frustrated by it, and it was very stressful. You know, after all, his plane was attacked. It was, on fire. He has to bail out. He comes down in a foreign country, has no idea where he is, doesn't know what happened to his buddies on the plane, can't communicate with the U.S. military. And he's being helped by complete strangers. And when he's initially shot down, they couldn't speak each other's languages. He had a little English-French dictionary in his escape kit that he could refer to. And any of these people helping him could be a German collaborator and turn him over to the Gestapo. And there are several instances described in the book about him almost being discovered. Finally, word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on June 6th of 1944. And my dad decided to get back in the fight. Unlike most airmen, my dad had that year's training in the infantry in the army, so he knew how to fight on the ground. And so he decided to join the French resistance. His helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was way too dangerous. He could die fighting against the Germans, or if they captured him, he'd be shot on the spot as a terrorist. But he felt it was his duty to get back in the war. There were Americans fighting and dying, and he wanted to do it. You know, I don't know how many people would have made that decision. I doubt if I would. I mean, the smartest thing and the safest thing to do would just stay hunkered down in hiding and wait till the U.S. armies came up through, you know, from up through France after D-Day.
I think that has been the theme this week, Steve. And if we do another week of Shotdown, I think that's the thing, is everybody's experience is completely different, and how they reacted to this situation, whether they were captured or not captured, whether they were in a POW camp and tried to escape or not tried to escape, whether they took it as an opportunity to learn, you know, carry on their education. Did they want to fight again? A 10-man crew would function as a family in a tight knit, you know, little group of specialists in the air, but on the ground, in this case, of course, some of them didn't make it, but how they would react to that experience would vary from pilot to co-pilot. Waist gun on the left, waist gun on the right, completely different reaction to being shot down. There's no right or wrong. The guys who chose to just stay and be hidden were fine. The guys who tried to escape were fine. It's a fascinating examination of the human mind.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So he did talk one of his help. This is the Bayou home in Charleroi, and it was one of the times that he almost got discovered. But one night there was pounding on the door, and Maurice told my dad to get up on the roof, and then he'd come get him when the Germans left the area. Well, they never left the area. My dad spent the entire night on that roof. And I've been in this house, and you really can't see it from this picture, but on the roof, there's an attic and a little tiny window, which you can barely fit through. And the roof is very steep, tile roof. I can't imagine crawling out that little window and getting up there. It'd be scary just climbing up there, let alone spending the whole night up there with Germans all in the area. This is another one of my dad's helpers, Amy Cool. She escorted him down to the French border on bicycles to meet up with the group of the French resistance. Here's what the French resistance was called, the Mackie. This is not the group my dad joined, but it gives you an idea of what they look like. They were small, independent, ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. And they basically harassed the Germans. They would sabotage railroad lines, disrupt communications, assassinate German officers, attack German convoys. And they got their information from the British over the BBC through coded messages. And my dad said the information they would give were unbelievably accurate. If they said a German convoy was coming down this road on this time, on this date, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything that the Germans were up to. They were also supplied by the British through airdrops. They stayed in this farmhouse just across the border into France, in Wallers, France. Here you see my dad standing in front of it in 1994. He stayed in this tower where you see the two windows. One morning, it was early, he was just in his skivvies, had shaving cream in his face, and he looked out those windows, and a German patrol came up the road because he had a really good view from that tower, as you can see there. So he jumped out the back of the farmhouse out of this window, and I've been in this farmhouse. It's amazing to be in these places where my dad was and where history took place. And he hightailed it into the woods to avoid being captured. And there's several encounters described in the book that my dad and this Mackie group had fighting against the Germans, which are pretty thrilling. Finally, 7 months after my dad bailed out, word came that there were nearby troops, U.S. troops, in the village of Trelon, France. So my dad walked into the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which would come up through France after D-Day. He identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. and he caught a ride on a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris. And then in Paris, got on a transport and went back to his base in England, where he sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle back at base and to bank the money because he had all that back pay coming.
Yeah.
Here, who took this picture and how it ever got back to my father, I'll never know, but this is my dad in front there fighting with the French resistance in 1944.
Wow.
Belgium is a wonderful little country. A lot of people don't realize it's actually divided in two. The upper portion is called Flanders, which was rather industrial, and they speak a dialect of Dutch, Flemish, and then the lower half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French. And my dad and the plane, they came down right at the French-Belgium border here. Actually, my dad and the plane came down in Belgium, and the other guys that were able to bail out came down in France. And they were brought back into Belgium, either by the French resistance or by the Germans. Here's just Charleroi. My dad was hidden there for lengthy periods of time. And then that farmhouse where the Mackie group stayed in Trelon, France, where he was liberated, is right around here. The Belgian people are wonderful people. Still today, they are so thankful and so grateful for the Allies and the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from 4 years of Nazi occupation and Nazi oppression. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations as well. Dr. Delahaye founded the Belgium American Foundation to honor and remember events that took place. And they've erected a number of memorials in the area. And on the anniversary of those events, they have ceremonies to honor and remember. Although the biggest ceremonies and the remembrance is around September 2nd, which was the date this area was liberated. And they're wonderful events. They last several days. This is a poster from the 70th anniversary. They erect these big tents that seat hundreds of people. This is just a portion of the tent. They have band concerts and lunches and dinners and dances, and they're really fun events. All the volunteers dress up in period costumes. They have a American Army military vehicle parade and set up a U.S. Army camp, and the local beer, Chimay, just flows, and everyone has a wonderful time. But they have more serious moments as well, where they have ceremonies at various memorials. This is the memorial at Cendron, which is right at the French-Belgium border and where the U.S. 9th Infantry first crossed over the Wartroise River from France into Belgium to liberate the country. And all the local villagers come out, the local dignitaries make speeches. The U.S. military is there, the French military, the Belgian military, the U.S. ambassador of Belgium comes down with an entourage. They're just wonderful, very moving events. And again, you can see all these young people up here in the front row, again, emphasizing the importance of remembering. This is a memorial to my dad and his crew. It was erected in Mackenwaas, Belgium, near where the B-17 came down. This was erected in 1989. And like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war until this. He and three other members of the crew that were still living at the time went over for the dedication of the memorial. And there they were. My dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him, revisited these places where he was hiding. And that brought it all back. And he started talking about it after that. And then 5 years later, I made my first trip to Belgium. And that's when it became personal for me, because I ran around to all these places with my dad. Here you see the dedication ceremony. This is Dr. Delahaye, I mentioned earlier. Here's my dad with the tie on. This is Jeanette Gadin, a woman that I showed you earlier that my dad hid with. This is Nellie Telkan. That's the wife of the Belgium customs officer, Paul Telkan. A couple months after he helped my dad, he was arrested and sent to prison and narrowly escaped being executed. But from the beatings he took to his head area, he developed a brain tumor and he died at age 50.
Oh dear, tragic.
And then this is the other Belgian gentleman that helped my dad down from the tree, Raymond Dervan. I've been to Belgium 6 times, and as I mentioned, I'm going back for my 7th time next year. But on 2 of my visits to Belgium, I continued on to Munich, Germany, to visit the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down my dad's plane. This was my first trip to Belgium with my parents. This is actually my sister, Nancy, my other sister. She was born while my dad was missing in action. So that was really tough on my mom, with Nancy being a newborn, one-year-old Susan Ruth, and then not knowing if she'd ever see her husband again. I mentioned I went on to Munich to visit Hans Berger, and we've become good friends. This is his apartment in Germany. I mean, here we are at his apartment. He has his fighter jacket on here, his Iron Cross. He shot down 7 B-17s and 1 Spitfire. He was shot down 3 times himself. Almost all his friends were killed during the war. The only reason I think he made it through the war is that at the beginning of 1945, he was pulled out of combat to become a test pilot for the Henkel HE-162 single-engine jet fighter that the Germans were trying to perfect, which they never did. But I think that saved his life, or he probably would have been killed if he had continued flying in 45. And here we are at the Hofbräuhaus in Munich, having a cold one.
And it's really, I'm really pleased that that you developed this friendship with the Luftwaffe guy who'd shot down your father's aircraft. Because, you know, of course, on this channel, we talk about the myth of the clean Wehrmacht. And of course, yes, everybody involved in the Third Reich was to some extent culpable in the crimes committed. And yet, beyond that, there can still be friendships. There can still be the spirit of reconciliation. There can be a coming together of people who are on opposite sides. And I think these kind of things are healthy. They're good. They're good for sharing history. They're good for putting to bed demons and the pasts and guilt and survivor's guilt. And so, we're complex people. We can take on board various ideas at the same time. And we can acknowledge that the Third Reich was an evil mechanism, but we can also respect a connection between former combatants. It's wonderful to see.
Yes, you know, he was pretty much, you know, Hans was pretty much like the U.S. airman. You know, he's a young guy, 19, 20 years old, trying to do a job, you know, fighting for his country and trying to stay alive. As Hans says, you know, we weren't all evil Nazis.
Yeah.
And, you know, World War II was the defining moment of my dad's life. I mean, nothing could match what he went through. And at one moment in time, my dad's life crossed paths with Hans. So he's a part of my dad's story, a part of my dad's life. And so I immediately felt kind of a kinship towards Hans when I first found him. I was so excited when I found Hans, because all my dad knew and all the Air Force knew is that he was shot down by 2 Focke-Wulf fighters. And that's all I thought I'd ever know until I found Hans. And then when I talked to Hans, I found out that the gunners on my dad's crew were the ones that shot down Hans. They actually shot each other down.
Wow.
Here you see me and my dad in 2004 at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. He wanted to visit it and see it before we died, so I accompanied my dad to a reunion of the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society. This was a picture taken right before the official dedication. And that was the last trip he ever took. He died 3 years later in 2007. He wasn't the last crewman of the Susan Ruth to die, but he was the oldest at 91. And today, you know, all the World War II veterans are in their late 90s or early 100s. At the end of the war, there were 16 million World War II U.S. veterans. And as this graph shows, you know, that number has been declining rapidly over the years. And now there's less than 1% of these men still with us. There was no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died. Millions more were wounded. Millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of the U.S. and the world forever. So the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are, to me, the greatest generation, and their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. So thank you.
Well, I mean, What a fantastic performance, Steve. I mean, I know you've done it before, but yeah, what a great story. And it has all the ingredients. I mean, as you said there, it should be a movie. If it, why isn't it a movie yet? I mean, it's got everything it needs. But you know, you said your father didn't talk about it for a long time. And one of the things that Holly Harris did on our Tuesday show is she didn't just end the story with liberation and end of the war, because it wasn't the end for these individuals. They carried with them survivor's guilt, or they had whatever it was. Although he didn't talk about it, and I don't want you to second guess for your father, you know, you said it was the most important time of his life, but how did, particularly that 7 months of being, you know, looked after by the Belgians and the French, how did that affect him in his later life? Did it give him an attitude of helping others? What would you take away from, even though he didn't talk about it, of how it affected your father?
Oh, gosh, that's an excellent question. Well, first of all, he just couldn't thank the Belgian people enough for saving his life. He looked at it that way. He said they would let him sleep in their bed. They would sleep on the floor. You know, food was rationed in occupied Europe. They'd give them the generous portion of the food. They would go hungry. So he kept in touch after the war with the people that he stayed with lengthy periods of time. So that really affected him after the war. My parents, like I am, they were devout Christians. And so one thing that really helped them get through the war was their faith in God and prayer. One thing that's really moving in the book is after there's lots of excerpts from letters from crew members or relatives. And especially after they were shot down, letters exchanged between mothers, wives, and sweethearts, which are really moving, about, you know, their fear for their loved ones and how, you know, five of them made it back and it was a glorious time, but five of them did not. And, you know, then their stories ended in tragedy. But my dad was proud, very proud of his service. He was a very patriotic guy, like I think all those guys who fought in World War II, and like the other guys, you know, they felt they were just one of, you know, millions just doing their job and doing their small part. And they came back home and just wanted to get on with their lives. My dad did suffer, I was told. I was born 2 years after the war ended in 1947. I think he got over it by then. But one of my aunts said that my parents had some issues. My mother said one time my dad was having this horrible nightmare and he started choking my mother. Wow. It did affect him from that standpoint for a little while. But we always looked at my dad and compared him to John Wayne. He was a big guy, no nonsense guy. You know, things were black or white, a disciplinarian, but a very loving father.
I mean, I think that the other recurring theme that came up this week is, particularly with the combined bomber offensive, whether you did two missions or you did 30 or 40, depending on what nationality you flew with, you're always at a distance from the fighting, in the sense that you're not seeing the results. You know, even the language they use, people don't die, they bought it. You know, they were talking about targets rather than destruction. It's that they were not protected from the war. Obviously they knew what they were doing, but there was they created a set of barriers between you, the crew, and the actual job you're doing. But if you're shot down and you're in Europe, you are absolutely therefore seeing what the people of Europe who are under the jackboot of Nazi tyranny are experiencing. You're seeing what happens to people who stand up against the Nazis. You're seeing the result of bombardments. You're seeing blown apart villages. Would you say, despite, you know, you wouldn't have wanted your father to be shot down, but those 7 months he spent there probably gave him a much greater insight into what the war was about than if he had just done a few missions at high altitude and gone back home? Is that a fair comment?
Well, absolutely. And one of the letters that my dad wrote to my mother after he got back to England, he was saying that, you know, you thank God that you don't live in Europe, and that you live in the United States, and you're not, and she or, you know, the Americans aren't going through or went through what, you know, the occupied countries did.
No, definitely. So we've got a question from Silent Green. What number mission was he shot down on? You may have said it and we've forgotten.
No, I didn't, but it's a good question. He was shot down on his eighth mission.
About the average, yeah. Just kind of almost hitting that kind of typical, yeah.
Yeah, some of his crew had more missions, some of the officers. Some of his crew had fewer missions. That one waste gunner that was in the hospital with frostbite and his ball turret gunner had been injured. They only flew two missions with his complete crew because someone's always sick or injured, what have you. My dad was the center on the squadron basketball team, and he tore the ligaments in his ankle, so he couldn't fly for 2 months. So that's one reason why some of his crew had more missions than he did. But in the letters that he wrote back to my mother, you know, he just wanted to get his missions over. He hated when missions got scrubbed or, you know, they couldn't fly because of the weather. He just wanted to get those missions in and get back home to his wife and his children.
Well, we've got a couple of questions for you from the viewers. So Lisa Loftus is saying, did his experience change his worldview or political opinions?
No, I don't think so. Like I said, he was very patriotic and loved his country. I know when the Vietnam War first started, you know, he backed and thought it was the right thing to do. But as the war went on and we discovered more about it, you know, then he was against the war toward the end.
Okay.
He was a Republican.
He just sounds like a true American. I think of the John Wayne analogy seems to be perfect for that. So Bruce Day is saying, what was the highlight of those 7 months? Because obviously there were moments of impending, you know, doom and danger. There was the fighting with the resistance, but was that meeting lots of people? Was there a particular highlight you think of those 7 months along with the low lights?
Oh, that's no one has ever asked me that question.
Well, we love to throw a curveball.
Not that he ever mentioned. He was fortunate. The Bayou family were fairly well off, and next door to the Bayou family lived a young 16-year-old girl. Now her name's escaping me off the top of my head. But she could speak English, and she taught him how to speak French. They would play, do crossword puzzles. They'd play cards and Monopoly. And she taught him. So my dad could speak conversational French pretty well. Mimi Gabriel was her name.
Okay, wow.
And
that would have been an enjoyable experience, because the isolation of being somewhere where you don't speak the language, you know, is tough. And also, you're enjoying having a conversation with someone from a different country, but also every bit of French he learned is going to be helping him in a situation that's coming. It's, you know, that ability to just be able to throw out a quick French sentence if you're stopped by a German or stopped by, but it might just save your life later. So I can imagine that was a highlight in some way. So I think we will end things there, but I'm just going to read what Gary said. Gary August said, superb presentation. Your father would be very proud of you for enlightening us about his story, his valor. To then go further and heal antagonists with opponents is truly remarkable. So I think that sums up what people think. It was a great story, well told, but also that had this this healing aspect to it, this reconciliation aspect, which is important to remind ourselves that not the people from a certain nation aren't all bad or all good. It's the take people one at a time. And that was a good vital lesson to learn. So, yeah, well, Steve, it's been great talking to you. Everyone's saying invite you back for something else in the future. So I will invite you back for something else. I know you've got guests and things staying with you, so you've got things to do today. But have you enjoyed talking to our World War II TV crowd?
Oh, absolutely. I do have another presentation I could do sometime. And that's to show all the places where the events took place that are still there today, where you can visit where the events took place, and also involves what happened to the other eight guys that bailed out.
Well, a part two. It sounds like we've got a sequel coming up. Well, I will invite you back for the next time we do a week, because as happens when I do a week like this, is people say, here's another author you should have on. Here's a book you haven't covered yet. So one week inevitably leads to another week later on. So I will invite you back when that comes. But I'm going to let you go now. So, folks, Nothing Tomorrow Sunday. Marty Morgan, World War II TV regular, is joining us for our first Operation Husky show. So not quite in line with the 80th anniversary of the invasion of Sicily, but it's because he's traveling around the world later. So he's going to talk about the role of 82nd Airborne jumping into Sicily. So I'm looking forward to that. And then next week, we've got a series of shows called Moments in History. So we're talking atomic bombs. We're talking African-Americans who received the Medal of Honor. We've got various subjects coming your way. The Battle of Leyte Gulf. So that's all coming your way next week. Steve, in the meantime, thank you very much. As always, the links to Steve's book, his website, are in the description below. I urge you to go out there and buy a few copies so he realizes that coming on World War II TV is worthwhile. So that'd be great if you can do that. So cheers, everybody. Thanks for watching. Thanks, viewers. Thanks, Steve. It's Paul Woodhouse for World War II TV saying enjoy the rest of your day. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.